Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Wilson Jeremiah Moses about his study of the life and thought of America's third president, entitled Thomas Jefferson, A Modern Prometheus. Wilson, welcome to New Books Network.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, there's not too much to say. I'm a pretty typical American academic, except that I went to Catholic school as a kid for 8 years in Detroit, Michigan. And after that, I went to Wayne State University back during the day when you could go to college without taking out a student loan. And I got most of my education I came from a family that did a lot of reading. We were Well, I think it was an intellectual family, but very poor. And so I had the advantage of a good literary background. But when it came to things like politics or involvement in labor unions or business and that sort of thing, I was somewhat disadvantaged when I started the college. Then I graduated in 1965, and I went towards a PhD in English. For a while, but then I transferred out of English into American Studies. I went to Brown University, thanks to affirmative action, and I completed my work there around the time that the United States was going through its centennial, in 1975, actually. And I've taught at a few universities around the country since then.
I was saying that broad background of reading that you described must have been very helpful for this book, because one of the things that I couldn't help but notice when I was reading it is just how wide-ranging it is of a study of Thomas Jefferson's thought. What was it that led you to write a book like this?
I'm interested in the fact that people are constantly invoking the founders of the Republic as if we could look at people who lived in the period from 1776 to 1789, and find a great deal of guidance for the present day. And I think that's a somewhat misguided idea, because after all, those people lived before the developments in modern communication and modern transportation, which are so important to us, and they had no concept whatever of what modern finance and modern economics would be about. Jefferson said something that I really found quite interesting. He felt that the Constitution would only be good for about 19 years. That gives you some idea of his intellect, because 19 years, I think, is the cycle that it takes for the moon to return to its position in the sky. And Jefferson thought 19 years was about as good as the Constitution was good for. But I think that his idea of having a constitutional convention every 19 years would have been impractical. Still, I don't think that he was a person who had a reverence. And he quite ironically once referred to the drafters of the Constitution as a group of demigods. I don't think he really believed that.
So you, at the beginning of your book, and this is reflected in the subtitle, you refer to Jefferson as a modern Prometheus. I was wondering if we could begin by unpacking what you mean by that, and how it was that Jefferson, you know, fits within that idea of the Greek myth.
Well, Prometheus was a type in Greek mythology. That is a figure who was very similar to the gods, but usually not included in the pantheon of the gods. He was a Titan, and he was known, depending on which of the Greek mythographers you read, he was known as the person who either stole fire from heaven and gave it to mankind, or he was the creator of mankind. The Greeks, after all, developed the myth of Prometheus, and they developed the mythology over a long period of time. And the earliest records we see of Greek mythology are about 800 years before Christ, and the more recent ones come about 400. So 400 years is a long time to develop the concept of any one of those Greek gods. But Prometheus is seen sometimes as the benefactor of mankind and sometimes simply as a trickster. What's also interesting about Prometheus, of course, is that some people associate him with Satan, who gave mankind the knowledge of good and evil. But as a bearer of fire and light, Prometheus was the one who ignited the revolution with his words about all men being created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Where he got those words is kind of questionable, but those are the words for which he's known. And those are the words for which he is celebrated, and they are constantly invoked both by people like Abraham Lincoln and by people today. Also, however, we see that his words are invoked by many revolutions, many revolutionaries, whether these are people who are revolting against their own government or who are revolting against colonial rule. But they're very popular words, and they have indeed inspired a lot of people. So whatever you want to say about Jefferson as a philosopher, we have to acknowledge that he was terribly influential with those very few well-chosen words. Not entirely of his own invention, but nonetheless, those are the words for which he is known. So he ignited the fires of revolution. He was therefore a kind of Prometheus. But he also was a Prometheus in the way that all American presidents are Prometheus. That is, he was a trickster. You can't be any sort of politician without being something of a trickster. You've got to be somewhat slick, and you have to have qualities of leadership. And there has been no president who hasn't been a genius at leadership. That includes the present president. Whatever you may think of the kind of leadership that they offer, the fact is that they're all geniuses at leadership, regardless of how stupid they may be in other respects. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that any of the presidents have ever been stupid, although I do think that some, very few, have been quite as intellectual as Jefferson.
Yeah, that question of a president's intellect is something that you address later in the book, and I'm hoping that we might be able to get to that. But one of the things that you do with this examination of Prometheus is you take it and you show how that perception of it has changed over time, basically how Jefferson's historical image has been adopted and interpreted by various political and historical thinkers in the centuries since. How has this notion of Jefferson changed, and in what ways has it been adapted?
Well, I forgot to mention one thing. That is, I stole the title of the book from Mary Shelley. Most people remember Mary Shelley for writing Frankenstein. In my day, she was known as the wife of Percy Bysshe Shelley, but the subtitle, A Modern Prometheus, I did get from her. Jefferson was a kind of Frankenstein monster then, to get to your question. He was a kind of Frankenstein monster to someone like Teddy Roosevelt, because he felt that that, like Frankenstein, he had created a monster. The monster being this idea of the hostility to central government that is so present in American life. That is, most Americans are very suspicious of the central government, regardless of whether they're on the right end or the left end of the political spectrum. Most Americans are suspicious of the press. Most Americans are suspicious of the government in Washington, and most Americans feel that Washington is a den of thieves. And I think that Jefferson is the progenitor of that kind of thinking. Nonetheless, he was a president, and as president, he embodied this this American quality of the trickster. That is, the person as Abraham looked said it. You know, you can fool some of the people all the time, and he was very good at doing that. As and I think every president has certainly been good at fooling some of the people all the time. And all of the people some of the time. So I think that Jefferson has had that reputation. Now, there was a school, there was a whole tradition of American historians who did not like Jefferson. And Abraham Lincoln was one of them. But it was necessary to always to pay a tribute to Jefferson, because Jefferson did articulate some ideas that were that have been popular to people of all political persuasions. Some people will take certain ideas of Jefferson out of their toolbox and emphasize those, and other people will select other tools, Jeffersonian tools, out of the toolbox. But a person like Lincoln was going to put a lot of emphasis on this idea that all men are created equal, although Lincoln understood that Jefferson did not mean anything like what Lincoln meant with that phrase. In fact, when Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, he was making a protest against the Dred Scott decision, because the Dred Scott decision had made it very clear that Jefferson did not mean all men are created equal. He didn't mean by any means to imply that that the African American population was equal to the white. And Justice Taney was correct in saying that. Lincoln just simply said, well, now, the Supreme Court Justice Taney has spoken. Now let him enforce it, because I've got the Army of the Potomac, and I'll tell you what Jefferson meant. And so it was very interesting, because he turned the ideas of the Jacksonians. He turned them completely around and used them against the last surviving of the Jacksonians, who was, of course, Justice Taney. And so Lincoln, I think, was one of those important interpreters of Jefferson. Now, when George Bancroft is called the father of American history, he just bought that Jeffersonian, he just bought that Lincoln line, hook, line, and sinker, and saw Jefferson as this great abolitionist. Of course, Jefferson was nothing of the sort. Jefferson was in favor of the abolition of the slave trade. He was in favor of the abolition of the Atlantic slave trade. And in the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, there was a very lengthy passage in which he condemned the Atlantic slave trade and condemned King George, and he blamed the Atlantic slave trade on King George. But Jefferson actually had married a slave trader's daughter. One of the reasons why he was in debt his entire adult life is that when he married his wife, Martha, he brought with her this debt, which he inherited from his father-in-law, from a very tragic venture in the Atlantic slave trade. And when that ship sank, when those slaves were lost in the slave trade, that was the basis of the Jeffersonian debt, which hounded him for the rest of his life. So while he was blaming King George for the slave trade, he had actually married into it. And that is one of the important ironies about Jefferson. And many people felt that Jefferson, when he made this long statement, this long pronunciation against the Atlantic slave trade, some people felt it was hypocritical. But other people felt that it was self-interested, because as James Madison pointed out in the Constitutional Convention, We Virginians are very heavily invested in the abolition of the slave trade. Of course, we Virginians want to see the slave trade, the Atlantic slave trade, abolished. Why? Because all of our wealth is tied up in slavery. Therefore, the law of supply and demand commands us to be opposed to the Atlantic slave trade. By opposing the slave trade, the international slave trade, we maintain the price of our slaves. We are involved in the domestic slave trade, but not in the Atlantic slave trade. But the people from Georgia and Virginia needed slave labor, and so they wanted to have that section removed from the declaration because they wanted low slave prices. And this is something that naive readers of Marx, or people who misunderstand or who misinterpret Marx, fail to grasp. Marx understood that not all capitalists have the same interests. Some capitalists were in favor of a high slave price, and some capitalists were in favor of a low slave price. We see the same thing today when some people are in favor, when some capitalists are in favor of high interest rates, and some capitalists are in favor of low interest rates. Capitalists do not always have the same interests. And that is one of the things we have seen continually throughout American history, and one of the things that complicates our congressional politics right down to the present day. But Jefferson's attitude towards slavery then was one of abolishing the international slave trade because, as Madison pointed out, Virginians were self-interested in having a high price of slaves. Now that led to his position on banking. He was always opposed to banking and to bankers because he was opposed to that variety of finance. His monetary system was based on promissory notes. People wrote promissory notes based on their credit, but they had to have collateral in order to write the promissory note. The collateral for a Jeffersonian would be their property in land and slaves. Hamilton and Washington, on the other hand, George Washington, was a vastly more sophisticated businessman than Jefferson was. Washington and Hamilton wanted a modern national banking system and a modern national system of finance. And this was the source of the conflict between Jefferson and Washington in the early Republic.
I think what you, to go back to an earlier point, one of the things that you describe points to one of the challenges, I think, in terms of approaching Jefferson, which is that his thought is so rich and it addresses so many topics that you really have to consider it all in terms of understanding him. And it's fascinating how people have been able to exploit that to pick and choose those parts of Jefferson which are part of who he is to support them.
Right.
So. Right. I was wondering if we could then perhaps start to delve a bit more deeply into specific areas of this thought. I'd like to start with your examination of Jefferson's ideas about labor and in both in terms of industry and the industrial sector, and then also in terms of agriculture as well, because it's very complicated one that in which slavery plays this obviously indispensable role in terms of how he thinks about labor. But also it reflects a lot of his ideas about, economics in general and the presence of industry in America.
Yes. Well, when I was, I started as an English major, and when I got to graduate school, that was when I first began to start thinking very seriously about Thomas Jefferson. And of course, I learned his very famous phrase, "Let our workshops remain in Europe." Well, I took that very seriously until around the time I started working on this book, and I happened to be at a cocktail party, and I was talking to a really bright colleague from the business school who was convinced that Jefferson was the father of American industry. And then I realized that the way they were teaching Jefferson in the business school was very different than the way they were teaching him in the American Studies department. Because in the American Studies department, we were always looking at Jefferson as the man who said, "Let our workshops remain in Europe," because we ought to be an agrarian empire. We ought to be an agricultural empire. Agrarian was a term that Jefferson very seldom used, and he used it in a very different sense than we use it today. But what I learned then as I studied more of Jefferson is that in his earlier writings, for example, in his summary view of the rights of British North America, Jefferson was very much concerned with American industry, and that was one of his reasons for opposition. One of his ultimate reasons for withdrawing from the empire was that the British were undermining the development of American industry. Now, during the War of 1812, of course, when the United States was cut off from British industry, that was a period that saw the development, the internal growth of American industry, and Jefferson was often quite put out with people who would remind him of his idea, "Let our workshops remain in Europe," because he was consistently in favor of American industry, and in fact, he made some attempts at industrialism right there at Monticello. He was never as successful an industrialist as George Washington was, for a number of reasons which I won't go into right now. But he really didn't have the head for business that Washington had. Jefferson died a very wealthy man, and Jefferson died just one footstep ahead of his creditors and left his daughter destitute. But Jefferson did always support the idea of American industry. However, the way that he would shield the American worker, and this is important, he always saw the American people as an agricultural people. And he said that if God ever did have a chosen people, it was the farmers. He believed that farmers were shielded from corruption, but that people who lived in cities and worked in factories would be corrupt. And so he wanted to guarantee, and one of the reasons for the Louisiana Purchase, he wanted to guarantee that this would always be an agricultural nation, because he felt that farmers were superior, or that farmers were at least smarter. But he was a very much sort of, I hate to make the comparison, but that was an idea that you found in Chairman Mao, the idea that that you always wanted to encourage the farmers and oppose these artificially educated, overly urbane, overly sophisticated city people who were corrupt. But this is a very common idea in Western thought. And it was an idea that was very, obviously it's a very important idea in Chinese thought as well. It's a universal kind of idea. But Jefferson did in fact encourage manufacturing, but he felt that you wanted to always see the agricultural person as less corrupt. And so that was one of the bases. But there was a certain element of hyperbole, a certain amount of exaggeration throughout Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia, which is where he said that. It's a book that's filled with hyperbole. He says many things that he doesn't absolutely believe. He says them for literary effect.
So we have this, so we have him, in effect, presenting this, literary idea of himself that people have misinterpreted in terms of his thinking about the economy. So how did he approach, economic thinking in general? On what was he basing it?
Well, these were ancient ideas. You find these ideas in ancient Greece and in ancient Rome. And the word agrarian, actually, as it was used in Jefferson's time, most notably by Thomas Paine, was a system of land redistribution. In fact, it was a kind of a socialistic idea. You took from the rich and redistributed to the poor. And there had been laws of that sort in ancient Rome, which is one of the reasons why Jefferson never used this word agrarian. Thomas Paine did. Thomas Paine believed in a redistribution of wealth, and Jefferson didn't believe in a redistribution of wealth. Jefferson did believe that there was a kind of legitimacy. Now, he felt that the question of whether or not property was a natural right, that was a moot question. You will note that the Declaration of Independence says that we have right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. But the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, as well as the writings of Locke say, life, liberty, and property. Why did Jefferson drop the word property from his Declaration of Independence? And if Jefferson did indeed, as many people think, if Jefferson did indeed have such a strong influence on the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, why then does the French Declaration of the Rights of Man say life, liberty, and property? Well, because Jefferson wasn't so sure about an inalienable right to property. No, the right to property came from, and I think this was somewhat true of Locke too, although Locke is not quite clear on his ideas on property. But Jefferson felt that that you had the right to property if you used property. That is a use theory. You had to use the property, and how should the property be used? And by this I mean real property or real estate. Real property. You gain the right to property by developing it agriculturally. So people who hunted on property, I'm sorry, my friends here in the state of Pennsylvania place a great deal of value on hunting, but Jefferson felt that the French aristocracy was not really entitled to their property because they set aside land for hunting. And there was so much poverty in France due to the fact that people set aside property for hunting. And this was part of the divine right of kings, part of the aristocratic prerogative. And he didn't have a great deal of respect for that. Now, to show you how universal he was in his thinking, he also felt the same thing about the Native Americans. They used the land for hunting. And of course, it wasn't true because they were actually farming communities. They weren't simply running around shooting arrows at deer. The American Indians were an agricultural people. Jefferson, however, would often justify his position about the appropriation of Indian lands in terms of the fact that, like those lazy European aristocrats, they used land for hunting. And they needed to be reeducated. They needed to be taught. They needed to be re-educated so that they would use them, so that they would become farmers, that they would become yeoman farmers with male-headed households, and that each would have that everything that the and that they would become a farming civilization after the model of what Jefferson saw as the ideal American yeoman farmer. So that was his theory of property. You owned real property because you used it for farming, and people like Marie Antoinette and the Native Americans, they really were misusing property because they used it for hunting.
I want to get to turn back to another aspect of what you were talking about with regard to the farmers and their superiority, because that ties into ideas that he had about liberty. And I was wondering if you could perhaps expand a bit upon your examination of Jefferson's ideas about liberty and how and the ways in which they've been, you know, interpreted and sometimes misconstrued in some respects by him, but also by people around him and since then.
Well, Jefferson said very famously that dependency breeds subservience and supplicates the germ of virtue. If you were dependent on someone, then you were sort of like Leporello in Mozart's opera Don Giovanni. If you were dependent, you were part of the servant class, and you were an employee. And Jefferson didn't this idea that we have today that the government should provide jobs. You know, the idea of jobs in Jeffersonian America was not necessarily a very positive idea. Nobody should have a job. You shouldn't have a job. You should have a farm. You should be an independent small capitalist. If you were an independent small capitalist, then you would owe nothing to anybody. Now, you could be a blacksmith. Jefferson had to make room in his philosophy for someone like Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Paine, who had a shop. Someone, that is to say, a shop in the sense of a workplace, a person who was engaged in small manufacturing, as indeed Jefferson was. And one of the ways, of course, that you made sure that you could be, but you didn't want to have a lot of employees. You see, one of the ways that Jefferson would preserve the freedom of people in Virginia is that he would never be employing a lot of white people in his factories. Jefferson had factories, if we call them that, at Monticello. For example, he made his own nails. He did small manufacturing, but the factory jobs were young African Americans, black adolescents, young kids, boys and girls who worked in his factories, and especially in his in what he called his nailery. That is where he made nails, which he tried to make not only for his use at Monticello, but for export to other plantations as well. This was never a profitable enterprise, but he tried to make it such. So the way that you would preserve, however, you would preserve the white youth from the dismal, dark, satanic mills, as his contemporary William Blake called them, by using only these black kids in your factory. You wouldn't corrupt whites by putting them to work. They were going to be farmers. But if you needed factory labor, well, this problem was solved by using these black adolescents in your factory. So the idea of liberty then was basically directed at whites. Whether the blacks were going to be free, that was something that that is very, very complicated. For one thing, Jefferson, although you wouldn't get any idea of this from this in his writings, you get the idea that Jefferson saw black on one extreme and white on the other. But there's pretty good evidence that he recognized gradations of whiteness. He did believe, and you can see this in his writings on animal breeding, which he cites when he's talking about slavery, that a certain amount of blacks could be absorbed into the white population and would become white. Now, in my own family, for example, my mother looked as if she were Italian. She was fairly light, fairly white, very white skinned, and white men would sometimes stand up when she was in the segregated South, growing up in the segregated South. One time, a white man stood up and offered her his seat on the bus. Sometimes my parents, when they went out in public, they were vilified. People would call them names because they thought that my father was a black man with a white woman. I have four granddaughters. Two look Italian, and the other two look like Scandinavians. They look like Norwegians. So this idea of the assimilation of black people is something that Jefferson was well aware of, and there is some evidence in the court cases that he represented that he was more inclined to be sympathetic to black people who were close to or almost white. But at the same time, he felt that black people couldn't really be free and live together. He was like Malcolm X in that. It was not very much like Martin Luther King, who believed that we could become a united and happy people. Rather, he was like Malcolm X, who believed that there would always be hostility between black and white. But I think when we look at Africa, we see that some of the greatest hatreds among are black on black. And when we look at Europe, we see that some of the hatreds that exist among Europeans are far greater than those that exist between black and white in the United States. Let us hope that it never gets any worse. But so far, the hostility between black and white and the mutual hatreds are not quite as bad as those which we saw in Germany in the 1930s when blue-eyed blondes were shoving blue-eyed blondes into furnaces.
It gets to an interesting point that I was thinking throughout your book about how relevant so much of Jefferson remains, not just in terms of the political thinking, but in terms of a lot of his ideas. I'm getting a little ahead of where you present these in the book, but when you engage with science and Jefferson's scientific thinking, you point out the degree to which how it correlates with our scientific thinking today, as well as it did within the contemporary thought of the late 18th and early 19th centuries.
Well, Jefferson lived at a time when Isaac Newton was seen as the ultimate in science, and everyone really believed, as Alexander Pope put it, heaven and heaven's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful, set of iambic pentameter. But the fact is that by the time Jefferson died, those scientists were already living. They were already born, who are going to find the anomalies, the inconsistencies in Isaac Newton. But Jefferson lived at a time when people thought that they had solved all the basic problems in physics. Remember, at that time, we still did not require that engineers study calculus. Engineers studied Euclidean geometry, and trigonometry, and solid geometry, but you could be an engineer without ever having studied calculus. And a person coming out, an engineer trained in those days, would be sort of like a college freshman in a science, in an engineering department today. Science, and the definition of science was quite different. As far as medicine is concerned, my gosh, the only people who knew anything about medicine were a few midwives and maybe some Native Americans who knew something about curing disease, but the average doctor didn't realize until 1900 that they needed to wash their hands before performing an operation. So the sciences and technologies of those days simply were not what they are today. The only person who really had a concept, a very well-developed concept of science, was Benjamin Franklin. Now, he was truly a genius. He really was a genius. He really had something of a scientific method. He understood something about the idea of coming up with some sort of a hypothesis, which you then tested under controlled conditions and which you hoped other scientists would be able to replicate. Jefferson talked a lot about his heroes, who were Francis Bacon and John Locke, and Isaac Newton, but he didn't really follow the scientific method that Bacon recommended, nor did Bacon, for that matter. Jefferson operated as a very traditional classic Aristotelian, by which I mean he tried to find a premise, an unchallengeable truth that he held to be self-evident. We hold these truths to be self-evident. And then you would deduce reality from those self-evident truths. Now, that's fine as long as we're talking about plane geometry. Certain truths are self-evident. A triangle does have three sides. You're never going to come across a triangle that has four sides. You're never going to find two parallel lines that meet. All right angles are congruent. Yes, those kinds of truths are self-evident. But that all men are created equal? Well, Jefferson took that back. He took that line back. By 1785, he had retracted that. He took that line back in his book, Notes on the State of Virginia. But where he really took it back was in a series of brilliant essays of an exchange of letters, which everyone ought to know, an exchange of letters between himself and John Adams, in which he talked about the natural aristocracy. That is, there was a natural aristocracy of virtue and talent, but there also were differences among people. Jefferson did not say all men and women are created equal. He didn't mean anything of the sort. He said all men are created equal, and that was what he meant. But what he meant was that, and that is what people are trying to figure out still. You're not going to find that at Wikipedia or any place else. What Jefferson really meant when he said all men are created equal. What I think he might have meant, is that all people, every human being, is entitled to a modicum of respect. But that's not what he said. He said all men are created equal, by which I think he meant that nobody should inherit a position as an aristocrat or as a king. That was what I think he meant.
I was thinking about your discussion of Jefferson and Francis Bacon in another respect, because what you do in there, you didn't mention this, is how you compare Bacon with another contemporary, Galileo Galilei. And I was thinking when you're describing how Jefferson thought Bacon was a superior scientist and thinker to Galileo, which is something that I don't think there are any scientists that would agree with that today, how the degree to which Jefferson might have been looking at Francis Bacon and have seen a 16th, 17th century equivalent to himself, you know, a person who, you know, was involved in a wide variety of fields, who made all these great contributions, in the sense that, that Bacon was closer to that model of Jefferson than Galileo was.
Well, that's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that before. That's an excellent point. Yes, he probably did see Bacon in there. After all, Bacon is one of the you are more likely today to study Bacon in an English in a British literature course than in a course on scientific method. I think Bacon certainly felt that Bacon did challenge certain Aristotelian principles, or these. And it's sometimes it's difficult to see the difference between Aristotle and Plato, because both of them did place a lot of emphasis on the idea of ideal models. You know, there were certain ideal models, whether these were to be found in geometry or where they were to be found. They both reverted ultimately to geometry, but I think that. And I think that what Bacon was trying to do was to get away from this kind of Euclidean approach to knowledge, and to say that we ought to acquire evidence. So systematic acquisition of evidence, and that we'll use an inductive method. We'll try to induce from our experiment rather than deducing from something that some principle that. That we inherited from the ancients, and I think that was what Jefferson admired about Bacon. But in his own method, he wanted to find a first principle, and he usually tried to find a first principle so that he could retreat to this practice of deductive. Platonic or Aristotelian logic, rather than operating as a in terms of inductive method, which I think Franklin was more inclined to use.
I was thinking about it from a another perspective as well. This gets to a broader part of your book, which is your discussion of Jefferson's genius. I especially thought it was interesting how you the chapter where you describe him as a Renaissance man in the Enlightenment, and how basically you're taking this idea of Jefferson, which we still see of this very widely practiced person, this who seems to exemplify this ideal that we associate with the late Middle Ages. And how it juxtaposes with a very different set of standards in the Enlightenment, and what that says about Jefferson and our concept of his genius.
Well, yes, by the time Jefferson died, we're finding people they're usually coming from not so much out of universities as coming out of the practice of practical engineering. They're coming out of workshops. These people like Benjamin Franklin, who are making inventions because they have hands-on experience. And these people who are making inventions, for example, Jefferson invented a plow, and so did George Washington. But George Washington's plow apparently was more practical than Jefferson's. But of course, we're coming now to the age of John Deere too. There were people who were coming out of fields like mining and technology, who are beginning to understand some things about the world. Jefferson thought the world had always been pretty much the same. He was not an evolutionist. He had a very difficult idea with his concept of evolution. He couldn't accept the idea that meteors fell out of the sky. He could only deal with that in a very flippant manner. When someone showed him a meteor, his very flippant response was, "Okay, well, you say it came down out of the sky, and I ask you then, how did it get up there in the first place? Chuckle, chuckle, titter, titter." But the fact is that rocks were falling out of the sky, and Jefferson just didn't like that idea, not one bit. Because that just wasn't the kind of orderly universe that he saw. Jefferson believed in a God of reason. Now that wasn't the God that you found in Genesis, and that's not the God that you find in St. Paul. So when Jefferson started going through the Bible to tell us what were the true words of Jesus Christ, he took his scissors, he took a razor, he took paste, and he cut out all the parts of Jesus that they didn't like. And he didn't include St. Paul. He didn't include the book of Revelation. He included only what he thought Jesus actually said. Well, how do we know what Jesus said? What is your method, Mr. Jefferson, as a literary scholar? How do you go about deciding which were the actual words of Jefferson and which were those that were inserted by a bunch of Catholics and evangelicals? which were the real? Well, he doesn't tell you. He just simply says, I know which were the words of Jefferson, of Jesus. And the words of Jesus were very much like the words of Socrates. So he picks and chooses. If Plato quoted Socrates as saying one thing and Xenophon quoted Socrates as saying something else, well, he just arbitrarily decided that Xenophon's right and Plato was a fool, the father of liars. But he wouldn't say why. Or when he came to someone like Phyllis Wheatley and she said she was a lousy poet, he never said why. So he was never very scientific in that sense, in that he felt that he had to give systematic introduction of evidence in support of his ideas. Certain things were just self-evident. Well, we can all make that mistake, by the way.
And that's something that I thought was, sorry, collecting my thoughts here. it's something that you see throughout a lot of his thinking, how he draws his conclusions. And that's one of the things that you do throughout your book, is you show how he does it in terms of science, in terms of these various fields, but you also see it as well in terms of his ideas about race, which, as you point out, he draws not just upon observation and first principles, but he also turns to what amounts to the scientific thinking of his time. He talks about animal husbandry and he takes those ideas and applies them to inform that, and sometimes in very arbitrary fashion.
Well, yeah, he did. To give him credit, he said, well, he simply suspected that the African people were inferior. He said, well, I won't condemn the whole race on the basis of what is just a suspicion, although my suspicion is that they are inferior. But he said, we'll wait for additional evidence. Of course, by this time, we have the beginnings, that is the seed roots of American knowledge. Of modern anthropology, because there were travelers in Africa who were beginning to make some reports about the kinds of cultures and civilizations that existed in Africa. Now, what is very interesting about Jefferson is that he was involved in the translation of the work of Constantin Volney, and Volney was convinced that the African people had indeed been the founders of Egyptian civilization, and that the African people had fallen from their ancient exalted state. When Jefferson translated Volney, he did not excise those portions, although you will find some translations of Volney that do excise those portions. One of the things I would say, my French is pretty lousy, but one of the things that I've discovered is that when Americans tend to look at a lot of French writers, they will look at translations that were made in the 19th century that were made by American racists, and they will overlook what the actual original French words said. This is true, particularly true of Gobineau. When Americans read Gobineau, 19th century French racist, he was a racist. But his thinking was much more complicated than most Americans are aware of, because they work with these 19th century translations that were made by American racists. Even when you go to Wikisource, you'll find that some of those chapters have been left out. But there is a black scholar who published in one of the black journals an article about that. I won't go into that right now. But Jefferson, when he translated Volney, he seemed to be aware that civilizations rise and fall, and that there was a time in the past when Africans were a more exalted civilization than we knew today, in his name.
There's one of the subjects that we haven't touched on yet, and I wanted to address it is you have a discussion of the role of women in Jefferson's life and how that also connects to his thinking about women. I was wondering if you could elaborate upon that a little bit and how, you know, how those, what ideas he had about women and how they may have informed or been informed by his exclusion of them from his consideration of rights and abilities.
Well, on the spectrum of his contemporaries, I like to judge Jefferson, and when we talk about race or when we talk about gender, I guess that's the term we use today, gender. When we talk about Jefferson in connection with race and gender, we have to judge him by how he stood with respect to his contemporaries. Now, some of his contemporaries were much more progressive than he was. For example, Aaron Burr and William Godwin were people who tended to view women as having a great deal more potential and much higher accomplishment than Jefferson did. But on the other hand, Jefferson preferred the company of intelligent women. He liked intelligent women. He liked accomplished women. And those are the kinds of women he had to have around him. Even with respect to Sally Hemings, who was the black woman who was his mistress, Jefferson, she must have had some elements of gentility that the average ordinary white dirt farmer didn't have. After all, she spent her adolescence in Paris. She must have known at least a little bit of French. I don't know if she was ever literate. But certainly the women who Jefferson surrounded himself with and who he preferred as his companions were women who were literate and intelligent, as for example his daughter Martha and his wife who played musical instruments, and she was literate too. We know very little about her. But Jefferson had a correspondence, as many people are fond of recalling, with Abigail Adams, who lost patience with him eventually. She simply stopped communicating with him. And the reason for that was that Jefferson, at the time of Shays's rebellion, Shays led a rebellion in Massachusetts, which represented the rights of the farmers as opposed to those of the bankers, of the banking class and the commercial class in Boston. Now, Jefferson, of course, sided with the farmers. And so did, and of course, the Adamses too thought of themselves as agricultural people. However, they felt that if the farmers in Virginia had risen up, then Jefferson's attitude towards the Shays rebellion might have been a little different when it was the farmers in Massachusetts. And Jefferson said that the tree of liberty must be watered with the blood of patriots and martyrs. That is the manure which nourishes the soil of liberty, etc. That sorts of statements. Well, Abigail Adams lost patience with him over that, but also in that brutal. You think that this presidential election this year is brutal? It hasn't got as brutal as it's going to become. Wait till the impeachment trial begins. Oh, we're going to see a whole lot of brutality at that point. But it's going to be directed at everybody, not just at the Republicans, but it's going to be directed at the Obama administration as well. It's going to be very brutal. But when that takes place, it will probably be as brutal as the election of 1800. And that was the point at which these accusations about Jefferson's relationship to Sally Hemings, his enslaved woman, first emerged, and I think Abigail just had a lot of difficulty with the idea of Jefferson she was, after all, a Puritan, you know, and this idea that you have this decadent Virginia aristocracy of which Jefferson was a part, which kept slave women as their mistresses. That was something that Abigail had a very difficult time with. Although we don't have a single letter in which she says that, but we can infer that from the letters she wrote. So Jefferson lived at the time of Mozart. He lived at the time of the Mozart operas. He sat in the opera and I made a point of this in my book. I made a point of that. He sat in the opera, and Mozart set to music a trilogy by the French a dramatist, Beaumarchais, which is the basis of two operas that we still know today, The Marriage of Figaro and The Barber of Seville. And in these two operas, we see the figure of Figaro, who represents the rise of a class of the lower classes, who nonetheless are protesting against the aristocracy. But what we also see in these opera is a challenge to the morality, this aristocratic morality, which victimized women of the lower classes. And that was one of the very important issues. But what we also see, if you read this trilogy by Beaumarchais, what you see is that Beaumarchais offers and some ideas for the humanization of males that are not present in Jefferson's thinking, a way of getting away from this double standard of sexual morality. And in the final of these plays, which Jefferson may have known, La Mère Coupable, which was not made into an opera. It was made into an opera very late in the 20th century. Nobody ever listens to it. But what you're seeing here is that the character of the Count is ultimately humanized because he has to deal with the issue of his wife's infidelity. This is not something that Jefferson, I don't think Jefferson ever reached that point. And I think that Jefferson never could grasp this idea that women belonged in the councils of men. Why? Because if women and men were together, then there was the possibility of promiscuous mingling. Now, this word promiscuous has a lengthy history in English. If you go to the Oxford English Dictionary, you will find that it's ambiguous at the time that Jefferson wrote. Promiscuous can simply mean indiscriminate mixing, but it can also have a sexual connotation. This idea of promiscuous mingling was one of the reasons why women did not belong in Congress and did not belong in government. And the other idea, as he said, he would never have dared say this to Abigail, but he did say this to one of the Schuylers. He wrote to, Angeline Schuyler, he wrote to her and he said, well, women, the fact that politics does not belong in the tender woman, bosoms of women. That of course is not the kind of idea that you would find in some of his contemporaries who certainly believe that women were equal in that sense as well.
Now, discussing all these ideas is enormously useful in terms of understanding Jefferson's thinking, which has had this enormous influence upon American and even world thought. But you also show how it plays out in terms of Jefferson's national careers, in particular, that period of time from the early 1790s through his presidency and into his post-presidency. And I was wondering if you could help us to understand how these ideas played out, to the degree to which Jefferson practiced what he preached and the degree to which he sometimes, when confronted with practical reality, maybe showed the limits of some of his ideas.
Well, we've seen that in our time. We've seen that in the presidency of Barack Obama, and we've seen it in the presidents of Trump as well. People have unrealistic expectations of the president. The presidents, and I think that these people who are very critical of Bernie Sanders or of Elizabeth Warren, anytime they make a statement, are seen to be withdrawing from statement they've made earlier. You know, the first thing you have to do before you're going to be elected, although elections in those days were elections conducted entirely in the Electoral College, but people expect first before you can govern, you have to first of all get elected, and many people are very critical. When a president is not able to follow the very letter of what they seem to have represented prior to becoming president. Jefferson was a very pragmatic guy, and I think you have to be if you're going to govern. But I think there are some principles on which you have to hold firm. And I think you have a person like Lincoln who was also very practical. There are people who feel Lincoln was a hypocrite because he didn't free the slave, because he didn't send General Sherman down into the South to liberate the slaves the day he was inaugurated, and who call Lincoln a hypocrite for that reason. And there are people who call Jefferson a hypocrite because he wasn't able to follow all the policies that seemed to be associated with his preachments when he came into office. Now, as a matter of fact, Jefferson is to be faulted for his shift on this expansion of slavery into the territories. At one point, he felt that the Republic could not continue to sustain slavery, but he changed his mind on that. So that while Lincoln's presidency, Lincoln's life was a process of becoming more and more liberal with respect to slavery, Jefferson was becoming more and more the conservative with respect to slavery. But on the other hand, the fact that Jefferson made compromises with respect to his economic policies, that is, appointing Albert Gallatin as his Secretary of the Treasury, when Gallatin was Hamilton on steroids, would lead one to think that perhaps he was inconsistent. Well, many people claim to have read. There is no historian, no graduate student in any history department in the United States of America today, or in England, who would, or in Germany, or in France, no graduate student would confess to not having read Henry Adams' history of the Jefferson administration. But if they had actually read him, they would see that Henry Adams is very critical of Jefferson, or not so much critical, but he got in quite a few digs. Henry Adams did not forget the conflicts between Jefferson and his ancestors. Both John Adams and John Quincy Adams. He didn't forget that, and he got in his digs. And Jefferson, he said, became more Hamiltonian than the Hamiltonians themselves when he was actually in office. He did use executive authority. He was the father of executive orders. People who don't like executive orders ought to take a look at Jefferson. And he did depart from this Adam Smith economics that he was supposed to have so thoroughly supported. The one great inconsistency in Jefferson, of course, was the great enthusiasm with which he could advocate the use of violence, the way in which he could beat the drums of war without ever having actually served in the Virginia militia. And there were among his contemporaries certain persons who never forgave him for that.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm working on a book which is inspired by my reading of the Grimm brothers. I'm kind of interested in German history and culture, and I've been reading a lot I read a lot of historical novels for pleasure, and mostly they're set in the Middle Ages. I'm interested in the evolution of certain ideas in the history of sexuality, and in particular in the history of heterosexual attitudes, and particularly in the relationship between brothers and sisters throughout history, from the time of Cain and Abel to the time of Richard Wagner. So I've been reading Wagner. I've been reading the Bible in translation, and I've been reading and rereading various versions of the Grimm fairy tales, Hansel and Gretel, his story called Brüderchen und Schwesterchen, and another one called the Little Fish and the little fish and the fish and fox. I think I remember what the other animal was, right? This is all the top of my head. But these animals, these brothers and sisters, they get translated, transformed into animals. They undergo progression from childhood to adulthood. In Hansel and Gretel starts off as a little sister, but by the time they're in the witch's house, it's she who's taking the she's who's taking the initiative. It's she's who the one who's doing the thinking. He's the one who's controlling the action. And all of these ideas are very interesting to me. And so it'll be a very thorough book covering a great deal of European history. I don't have a knowledge of Hebrew, which is something that makes me sad. I do know German fairly well, but not French after a fashion. But I don't. I had 2 years of high school Latin, which amount to nothing. And it would be better for me. I'd be happier if I knew languages about a lot better than I do. But I'll just have to work with what I've got.
Well, that sounds like a really fun project. I wish you the best with it.
Well, thanks.
Well, Wilson Moses, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too.